we're going to do tonight, we're going to try to be contemplative in our reading. There's not going to be any format, any order. I think it would be a disservice to the authors and to the readers to order them. And so we have a collection of community books up here. Khalil Gibran, Walt Whitman, Robert Frost, the Norton Anthology, the Bible, and Thomas Merton. And I have a Gerhard Frost book and a couple of books on Earth, nature, spirituality, and poetry. And if you haven't brought anything tonight and you feel so inclined that you'd like to read something, perhaps they shouldn't be in front. Why don't we put them on the side in case you want to look while someone is reading. Feel free to go out and get more coffee, but out of courtesy to the readers, I'd like you to wait until they're done with their presentation. And since it is contemplative, I think we'll just start off with I guess I didn't have anything to start off with, so we'll just start whenever.
Can contemplative be funny as well?
I'm not sure my poems are at all contemplative.
Well, it doesn't have to be.
Mine are not.
It doesn't have to be totally serious.
Oh, okay.
But it's, I guess, contemplative from the standpoint of that we're going to try to, contemplative is the best word I could think of to describe how we're going to order it tonight. So,
respectful.
Respectful, there we go. Just chaotic. How about entropic? Is entropic better, Robert?
Yeah, that's good.
Rapid random like increase of disorder.
Yeah.
Kind of like our bodies are going to sooner or later just fly apart.
Yeah.
Fair. Okay. Entropic. Enjoy the entropic night of poetry. And also, you can sit in your place if you'd like to read there, or you can stand up or whatever.
Can we stop around the room and stuff?
Certainly. If you'd like to sit in that bowl, too, that's better. I can't guarantee it will hold you. And also, when you read your poem, you can either, if it's by you, you can say that it's so, or you can just not say that it's so. But if it's not by you, I guess I would appreciate it if you would tell us who it's by, and the title as well. Thank you.
I'd like to get a serious one out of the way. It's written by a friend of mine. Me. But everything much of what I write that is religious sounds sermonic anyway. I hope not. A couple of words. It's entitled Easy Easter? Easy Easter. As if resurrection is like getting out of bed or getting in. As if resurrection had nothing to do with death. It was only about life. As if death were not alive and well and living in a soul. Easy Easter. Facile feast. The words and food and color. As if resurrection can be painted on or sprayed over. Or donned like a new spring coat, or stapled to, or scotch tape on, as if resurrect were an intransitive verb.
Well, this one seemed like a good one to kind of help start out too. It's called Invincible, and it's by Terence Gandridge. I shall strike your heart like arrows dipped in the fluid of truth, I shall tell you of your fondest dreams and shake you with reality. You will become as I cast reflections on the mirror of your soul. These things I shall do. I am the poet.
I'd like to preface this one with, unfortunately, Tom Holsinger Fuchs is not here tonight, but maybe you can tell him. When I got off the bus here, I looked up the buckskin, I looked up the copper, I looked up the dumbbell, and I said, I'm going to climb it. And after climbing buckskin inferno, I realized it's not an easy task. And that it is much more important to concentrate on the actual just concentrate on the mountain and not on conquering anything. Robert Persick writes in the Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, mountains should be climbed with as little effort as possible and without desire. The reality of your own nature should determine the speed. If you become restless, speed up. If you become winded, slow down. You climb the mountain in an equilibrium between restlessness and exhaustion. Then when you're no longer thinking ahead, each footstep isn't just a means to an end, but a unique event in itself. This leaf has jagged edges. This rock looks loose. From this place, the snow is less visible, even though closer. These are things you should notice anyway. To live only for some future goal is shallow. It's the size of the mountain which sustains life, not the top.
Perhaps a lighter one. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had a bad thought about anybody else? Or another person? I confess that I often have bad thoughts about other people. When you kind of imagine that in community, you don't ever have bad thoughts about other persons in the community. This is in a monastery. It's a poem, Soliloquy of a Spanish Cloister, and I regret to say that a monk is having a bad thought about another monk. Soliloquy of the Spanish Cloister by Robert Browning. There go my heart's abhorrence. What are your damned flower pots do? If hate killed men, Brother Lawrence, God's blood would not mine kill you. What? Oh, your milkstone bush wants trimming? Oh, that rose has prior claims, needs its leaden vase filled brimming. Hell dry you up with its flames. At the meal we sit together. Salve, Tibby. I must hear, for eyes talk of the kind of weather, sort of season, time of year. Not a plenteous cork crop, scarcely, dare we hope, O Gauls, I doubt. What's the Latin name for parsley? What's the Greek name for swine's snout? Phew, we'll have our platter burnished, laid with care on our own shelf, with a fire new spoon we're furnished, and a goblet for ourselves. Rinsed like something sacrificial ere 'tis fit to touch our chaps, marked with L for our initial. There his lily snaps. Saint, forsooth. While brown Dolores squats outside the convent bank with Sanchicha, telling stories, steeping tresses in the tank, blue, black, lustrous, thick like horsehairs. Can't I see his dead eye glow? Brightest where a Barbara Corsairs, that is, if he'd let it show. When he finishes reflection, knife and fork he never lays crosswise, to my recollection, as do I in Jesus' praise. I the Trinity illustrate drinking watered orange pulp in three sips, the Arian frustrate, while he drains his at one gulp. Oh, those melons! If he's able, we're going to have a feast. So nice. One goes to the abbot's table. All of us get each a slice. How go on your flowers? None double? Not one fruit sort can you spy? Strange. And I too at such trouble keep them close nipped on the sly. There's a great text in Galatians. Once you trip in it, entails 29 distinct damnations. One sure if another fails. If I trip him just a dying, sure of heaven as sure as can be, spin him round and send him flying off to hell, a manichee. Or my scrofulous French novel on grey paper with blunt type. Simply glance at it, you grovel, hand and foot in Belial's gripe. If I double down its pages at the woeful 16th print, when he gathers his green gauges, or perceive and slip it in it. Or there's Satan, one might venture, pledge one's soul to him, yet leave such a flaw in the indenture as he'd miss it, till past a tree blasted lay that rose acacia we're so proud of. Hides I in east. There's Vespers, plena gratia, Abbey Virgo. Grrr, you swine.
Good to have a religious note.
Well, I have something really light that I wrote today. I haven't written poetry in a long time, and I've been rather unhumorous lately, so I thought I'd take a shot at humor today. I kind of wanted to concentrate on things that have happened just recently in the last couple days, so that just to show that I'm noticing for myself, that I'm noticing things that are around me. A humming down the road, blowing sawdust from my nose, I spied a little creature, almost squished him through my toes. He had no fear. Yes, he was quite a brazen fella. And when he cocked his eye, he looked just like a Beretta. I thought he'd run most like most small creatures do, but then he glared at me like, "Hey, bud, you ain't got no clue." I stood in silence, not knowing what to say, so he kicked some gravel at me and went upon his way. The little creep, he really changed my mood. I had no idea chipmunks could be so rude. Then it struck me later what good old Tom had said. They eat too much. People feed them till they're dead. I guess I spoiled his expectations.
That's good.
I have a couple, one or two. My favorite is Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, A Song of Life. Tell me not in mournful numbers, life is but an empty dream, and the soul is death that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. An enjoyment, and not sorrow, is our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow finds us farther than today. Then I have another one, Tree, by Joyce Kilmer. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree, a tree that may in summer wear a nest of robins in her hair. Poems are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree. And then I have one little tiny short one. The years have taught me many things, but none so sure as this, that shelter, solace, joy, and strength are always where God is. So now when hope and courage fall, and only fear is strong, my heart will sing as in the past, an unforgotten song. God is my refuge and my strength. I will not be afraid. And though the night be wild and dark, I'll meet it undismayed. Authors unknown there.
I have one by a woman called Barbara Bowles, and it's called Social Security. She knows a cashier who blushes and lets her use food stamps to buy tulip bulbs and rose bushes. We smile each morning as I pass her, her hand always married to some stick or hoe or rake. One morning I shout, "I'm not skinny like you, so I've got to run 2 miles each day." She begs me closer, whispers to my flesh, "All you need, honey, is to be on welfare and love roses."
This is a poem for Claudia. It's a poem I memorized about 9 years ago in a German class. And I don't remember who it's by, but it's called Elisabeth. Wie eine weiße Wolke am hohen Himmel steht, so weiß und schön und ferne bist du, Elisabeth. Die Wolke geht und wandert, kaum hast du ihre Acht, und doch durch deine Träume geht sie in dunkler Nacht. Geht und ergänzt so silbern das Wort von ohne Rast, du nach der weißen Wolken ein süßes Heimweh hast.
Danke.
Well, as everybody here knows, I'm very serious about poetry, so I chose some A.A. Milne. This one I selected because I just noticed today that it's 3 months to Christmas. Couldn't get over it. King John's Christmas. King John was not a good man. He had his little ways. And sometimes no one spoke to him for days and days and days. And men who came across him when walking in the town gave him a supercilious stare and passed with noses in the air. And bad King John stood dumbly there, blushing beneath his crown. King John was not a good man, and no good friends had he. He stayed in every afternoon, but no one came to tea. And round about December, the cards upon his shelf, which wished him lots of Christmas cheer and fortune for the coming year, were never from his near and dear, but only from himself. King John was not a good man, yet had his hopes and fears. They'd given him no present now for years and years and years. But every year at Christmas, while minstrels stood about, collecting tribute from the young for all the songs they might have sung, he stole away upstairs and hung a hopeful stocking out. King John was not a good man. He lived his life aloof. Alone he thought a message out while climbing up the roof. He wrote it down and propped it against the chimney stack. To all and sundry, near and far, for Christmas in particular. And signed it not Johannes R., but very humbly, Jack. I want some crackers, and I want some candy. I think a box of chocolates would come in handy. I don't mind oranges, and I do like nuts. And I should like a pocket knife that really cuts. And oh, Father Christmas, if you love me at all, bring me a big red India rubber ball. King John was not a good man. He wrote this message out and got him to his room again, descending by the spout. All that night he lay there, a prey to hopes and fears. I think that's him coming now. Anxiety bedewed his brow. He'll bring one present anyhow, the first I've had for years. Forget about the crackers, and forget about the candy. I'm sure a box of chocolates would never come in handy. I don't like oranges, and I don't want nuts, and I have got a pocket knife that almost cuts. But, oh, Father Christmas, if you love me at all, bring me a big red India rubber ball. King John was not a good man. Next morning, when the sun rose up to tell a waiting world that Christmas had begun, and people seized their stockings and opened them with glee, at crackers, toys, and games appeared, and lips with sticky sweets were smeared. King John said grimly, "As I feared, nothing again for me." I did want crackers, and I did want candy. I know a box of chocolates would come in handy. I do love oranges, and I did want nuts, and I haven't got a pocket knife, not one that cuts. And oh, if Father Christmas had loved me at all, he would have brought a big red India rubber ball. King John stood by the window and frowned to see below the happy bands of boys and girls all playing in the snow. A while he stood there watching and envying them all, when through the window, big and red, there hurtled by his royal head and bounced and fell upon the bed an India rubber ball. And oh, Father Christmas, my blessings on you, Father, for bringing him a big red India rubber ball.
I was out in August, little part of August, and Tacoma, and on my way back, I had a day over to Seattle bus station. And I wrote this after I had a conversation with a man named Terry. He was homeless outside the bus station, and he was drunk. And this is Terry. "Hey, sir, can I ask you an honest question?" "Sure." "You will give me an honest answer?" "Sure." "I need 27 cents for a bottle of beer." "Why not food?" "I already ate." And I'm not so sure what the poem that I wrote, I'm not so sure how much it has in common with that dialogue, but the poem is entitled Homeless. "I am homeless with nowhere to go. The world crowds by and around me, some wondering silently and others out loud, how a person could sink as low as me. What they don't know, as they race so hurriedly past, is my history. The people I've loved and lost, and other hardships I've known. And that from my place, I can see the world as it truly is."
I'm going to share one I wrote. I don't write much poetry, but what I've written in the past couple years is, it always seems to come out just really fanciful, I guess, kind of whimsical. And a lot of it seems to be about family or mothers and children and stuff like that. And I wrote this one on choir tour this year, April 19th. We were way, way up north in Saskatchewan, and it was really, really warm outside. We had half an hour before the choir had to go cram in this tiny church and sing for these people. I was watching some families that were getting ready to come to our big concert, and I was laying out on the church lawn, and the snow had all melted, so the grass was all, it was blonde and crunchy. So I started grass, scratches, crunches under a rolling, lolling, tumble baby. And sweet little child, honey from her breakfast toast, sticks leaves to her delicate little fingers as she picks up tumble baby. Look at you, the pair, the two of my sky and my ground. Dance and play, wiggle and giggle to the pretty blonde grass and the tall, tall trees. Crowns and crowns of clouds and gowns of flowers, pardon me. Glossy-eyed, glimmer-wide, grins settle in, fresh rest. all of us best to hold young, hold old, hold family, hold earth. It's about my kids and my family someday, I guess. And while I'm on the line of family, I always seem to talk about my brother lots. And I remember my brother, he's 1 year older than I am, and I remember that when we were young, we were constant companions, and when he used to get upset with me, he would do one of two things. He would either hurt me and then blame it on a ghost or something, or he'd tell me that I wasn't really his sister, I came from gypsies. And that's really true. And I would cry a lot. And this Shel Silverstein poem, I'm a real big Shel Silverstein fan, and this poem just reminds me of something that that he would have read to me. It's called "The Gypsies Are Coming." The gypsies are coming, the old people say, to buy little children and take them away. 50 cents for fat ones, 20 cents for lean ones, 15 cents for dirty ones, and 30 cents for clean ones, a nickel each for mean ones. The gypsies are coming, and maybe tonight, to buy little children and lock them up tight. 80 cents for husky ones, quarter for the weak ones, penny each for the noisy ones, and a dollar for the meek ones. 40 cents for happy ones, 11 cents for sad ones. Kitties, when they come to buy, it won't do you any good to cry. But just between yourself and I, they never buy the bad ones. Since it's still quiet, I have two more that aren't mine. I was going to read these because this person was not going to be here, and she's turned up, but I'm going to read them anyway. Megan wrote these. And the first one, I get the feeling, was written by the creek. It's called "Scared." Wow, beauty at its best. Water twisting around these corners in a hurry to get nowhere in particular. One branch cries out, "Help me! Don't pull me out of the water, just set me free." But I am unable, because right now, I'm afraid of getting my feet wet. And the second one was written with a certain friend of mine, and Megan's decided to dedicate it to someone whom she shared with me, has had a lot of influence on her thinking, and has become an important person in her life. So this is for you, Chris. It's called "Who Is It?" I keep looking over my shoulder. Someone watching you? So what? But it is uncomfortable. I think I'm alone. In fact, I'm positive there's no one here but me. Surrounded by nature, what a tremendous feeling. But again, I feel eyes on me. And again, I'm looking over my shoulder. Who's there? Someone I know? Well, yes, someone I know well. Or so I thought. I see myself sitting on a log, watching the creek and feeling the heat of the sun. I see myself turn occasionally to look over my shoulder. And as I watch myself watching, I wonder just who it is I'm looking for.
I had a real short one that I wrote about my first work assignment today.
I
have some poems from Dom Helder Cabero, who was Archbishop in Brazil. Just get up in the middle of the night almost every day and write some, just two or three of these. I like the sort of birds that fall in love with stars and drop, worn out from trying to catch their light. The unattainable ideal. Who will grant me to be as loyal, discreet, and silent as my shadow is? I think I like this one probably the best. I pray incessantly for the conversion of the prodigal son's brother. Ever in my ear rings the dread warning. The one has awoken from his life of sin. When will the other awaken from his virtue?
About this time of year, every year since I came back from Africa, I think a lot about Africa, and I think I'll read a couple of poems that I wrote actually a few months after I got back from Africa. The first one I'm happy to say is no longer a true poem. It's called Nelson. 26 years away from the world, dying for 26 years to give life to those who throw it back in his face with a slap. 26 years alone, yet joined by a community of thousands, children, mothers, fathers, blacks, whites, who cannot take away his pain, but can share the burden, bear the despair which must lay heavily upon his shoulders, day in and day out, 26 years of despair, cutting him down, trying anyway. But he persists in the name of freedom. 7 years old, yet he persists. These 26 years shall never be returned, yet they have been given. 26 years, my own life and a year in prison. Do they really understand what they are doing? He has given his life for freedom. Does he know what he is doing? My God, why do you forsake those who are your true vessels of peace? Let him free. Let them free. Let us all free. He has given his life. 26 years. What more can he give? Set him free. And the other one is called Let the Children Sing. I'm never sure if it makes much sense to anybody but me, because there's a lot of background to it, but part of the title comes from the school I was in Botswana. Every morning had something called assembly, and the children all sang every day. So part of that is why it's called Let the Children Sing. Pain boils as a cauldron full of glue, the witch's broth to trap, seething. Swirls of agony searing as they twist and turn through the corridors, the vessels of blood filled with no end of despair and no presence of life. Children sing a song, and a valve opens with a creak as a tear slides out, trickling down a cheek. Explosion and of colors, one against the other, and the top flows, streams of water gushing, washing away all debris in its path, floods of relief, calm, pain subdued, manageable. Until there is no more pain, let the children sing. Until despair can turn to hope, let it be sorrow. Volcano as a spring, release me, oh, let the children sing.
The most intense think it takes friendships I've made have been here the last couple of months. And I wrote this poem to Jamie Haith and Michael Mastin. Two men that were here for 3 weeks, but it seemed like much, much longer. It's entitled Friendship Pie. Time cut in wedges like pie. Our appetites determine the size of the piece. The taste of friendship pie is pleasantly tart. Our memories fade gradually over the days apart, but we shall not easily forget the day when we cut our first slice.
Well, again, a children's poem in a lighter vein from A. A. Young. I'm not sure that this one means anything. It's fun. Of all the knights in Appledore, the wisest was Sir Thomas Tom. He multiplied as far as 4, and knew what 9 was taken from to make 11. He could write a letter to another knight. No other knight in all the land could do the things which he could do. Not only did he understand the way to polish swords, but knew what remedy a knight should seek whose armor had begun to squeak. And if he didn't fight too much, it wasn't that he did not care for blips and buffeting and such, but felt that it was hardly fair to risk by frequent injuries a brain as delicate as his. His castle, Castle Tom, was set conveniently on a hill, and daily, when it wasn't wet, he paced the battlements until some smaller knight who couldn't swim should reach the moat and challenge him. Or sometimes, feeling full of fight, he hurried out to scour the plain, and seeing some approaching knight, he either hurried home again or hid, and when the foe was past, blew a triumphant trumpet blast. One day, when Sir Thomas Tom was resting in a handy ditch, the noises he was hiding from, though very much the noises which he had always hidden from before, seemed somehow less, or was it more? The trotting horse, the trumpet blast, the whistling sword, the armor's squeak, these, and especially the last, had clattered by him all the week. This was the same, or was it not? Something was different, but what? Sir Thomas raised a cautious ear and listened as Sir Hugh went by. And suddenly he seemed to hear, or not to hear, the reason why the stranger made a nicer sound than other knights who lived around. Sir Thomas watched the way he went. His rage was such he couldn't speak. 4 years they had called him down in Kent, the knight whose armor didn't squeak. And here and now he looked upon another knight whose squeak had gone. He rushed to where his horse was tied. He spurred it to a rapid trot. The only fear he felt inside about his enemy was not how sharp his sword, how stout his heart, but has he got too long a start? Sir Hugh was singing, hand on hip, when suddenly something came along and caught him a terrific blip right in the middle of his song. A thunderstorm, he thought, of course, and toppled gently off his horse. Then said the good Sir Thomas Tom, dismounting with a friendly air, "Allow me to extract you from the heavy armor that you wear. At times like these, the bravest knight might find his armor much too tight." 100 yards or so beyond the scene of Sir Hugh's defeat, Sir Thomas found a useful pond, and careful not to wet his feet, brought the armor to the brink and flung it in and watched it sink. So, after more and more, the men of Kent would proudly speak of Thomas Tom of Appledore, the knight whose armor didn't squeak. While Hugh, the knight who gave him best, squeaks just as badly as the rest.
Well, I do have just one more that I wrote today.
Mm-hmm.
This poem is about when Pam told me about her hearing the owl outside her window the other day. She woke at 5, wondering what's the matter. She heard a sound, sweet, unlike the daily clatter. She turned to Tom to see if it was he, for often he snored and drove her up a tree. She poked about him and gave his mouth a close, but was it but the wind whistling through his ears and nose? Then it came again. Surely it was not he. It came from outside, high inside the tree. Like a voice, it asked a simple question. On the highway, it's hard to find a restroom. I couldn't find anything to rhyme with that one. Who, said the owl in a scholarly fashion. I don't know, said Pam. Just let me go back to sleep.
I just asked Robert to help me with another Shel Silverstein poem. It's called Poor Angus, but I'm going to change the name. Oh, what do you do, poor Robert, when hunger makes you cry?
I fix myself an omelette, sir, of fluffy clouds and sky.
Oh, what do you wear, poor Angus, when winds blow down the hills?
I sew myself a warm cloak, ma'am, of hope and daffodils.
Oh, who do you love, poor Angus, when Jan has left the moor?
Ah, then, sir, then's the only time I feel I'm really poor.
Somebody asked me to read some Burns. I never quite understand that because I'm not sure that anybody understands what I'm reading. These are environmental poems, to please Al. The way Burns viewed what happened when he exercised his dominance over the creation and how he felt poorly about it. This is to a mouse. Burns was a ploughman when he wasn't a poet. He was a ploughman before he was a poet and a farmer. This is to a mouse. I'm turning her up in her nest with the plough. In November 1785. Wee sleekit curin timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start away so hasty wi' bricker and brattle. I would be laith to run and chase thee wi' murdering battle. I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union, and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal. Thy wee bit housey too in ruin, its silly wars the winds are strewing, and nothing now to big a new one or foggage green, and bleak December's winds ensuing, base snell and keen. Thou saw the fields laid bare and waste, and weary winter coming fast, and cosy here beneath the blast thou thought to dwell, till crash, the cruel coulter passed out through thy cell. That wee bit heap of leaves and stibble has cost thee many a weary nibble. Now thou's turned out for all thy trouble, but house or failed, to thaw the winter's sleety dribble and cranrach cold. But mousie, thou art no thy lane in proving foresight may be vain. The best laid schemes of mice and men gang after glee, and leas nought but grief and pain for promised joy. Still, thou art blessed compared with me. The present only toucheth thee. But oh, I backward cast my ee on prospects drear, and forward, though I canna see, I guess and fear.
What was the name of that one?
To a Mouse.
My dad used to quote a line in that all the time, so I just want to...
Yeah. There's a common line. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to know where it comes from. This is another one, another environmental one. It's kind of interesting. It's to a mountain daisy which he turned down when he was ploughing. And in the poem, his treatment of the daisy makes him think of his attitude to women. And he was very fond of lassies, Robert Burns. Anyway, wee modest crimson tippet flower, thou's met me in an evil hour, for I'm uncrushed among the stour thy slender stem. To spare thee now is past my power, thou bonny gem. Alas, it's no thy neighbour sweet, the bonny lark companion meet, bending thee mang the dewy wheat, wee speckled breast, when upward springing blithe to greet the purpling east. Cold blew the bitter biting north upon thy early humble birth. Yet cheerfully thou glinted forth amid the storm, scarce reared above the parent earth thy tender form. The flaunting flowers our gardens yield, high sheltering woods and wa's mun shield, but thou beneath the random build of clod or stain adorns the histy stibble field, unseen, alone. There in thy scanty mantle clad, thy snowy bosom sunward spread, thou lift'st thy unassuming head and humble guise, but now the share uptears thy bed, and lo, thou lies. Such is the fate of artless maid, sweet floweret of the rural shade, by love's simplicity betrayed, and guileless trust, till she, like thee, all soiled, is laid low in the dust. Such is the fate of simple bard, on life's rough ocean luckless starred, unskillful he to note the card of prudent lore, till billows rage and gales blow hard, and whelm him o'er. Such fate to suffering worth is given, who long with wants and woes has striven, by human pride or cunning driven to misery's brink, till wrenched of every stay but heaven, be ruined, sink. Even thou who mourn'st the daisy's fate, that fate is thine, no distant date. Stern ruin's plough shares drives elate, full on thy bloom, till crushed beneath the furrow's weight shall be thy doom.
Two short writings. One's by Dorothy Day, who was a Catholic worker, and she worked for the homeless, which she helped start the Catholic Worker Movement. And so she ran into lots of different types of people. But strange and wonderful, the make-believe come true. If you will to love someone, you soon do. You will to love this cranky old man, and someday you do. It depends on how hard you try. This is also found in one of her books, but it's written by Chardin. Someday, after mastering the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness for God the energies of love. And then, for the second time in the history of the world, man will discover fire.
There's really no timeline tonight, but I think just, you know, you can just pick up and leave if you'd like. I graduated in May with a degree in biology. I hope to teach someday. And this poem by Gerhard Frost, from the book Seasons of a Lifetime. All I can say is that I wish that I could be as profound as his daughter is here. This is entitled Science Lecture. I held her warm hand as we walked in the park at sunset by the lake. My mind recorded her kindergarten lecture. She chatted on. See the fluxions? That's the fish's world. And do you know the sun is always shining and the night is always nighting? Because you see the world is round. I paid tuition for less.
Touche.
Well, I have one that I really like, and Robert and Jan probably have heard this. I did it for a best friend's last year. It's called Grandchildren. The grandchildren haven't turned out the way we thought they would. Their parents, my children, are hurt and angry, ashamed and worried about it. I'm not. To tell you the truth, I like these kids, the way they are, open and honest, disorganized and gentle, scruffy and kind. They don't seem to mind spending time with me. We talk about real things, dreams, peace, the sky. They tell me living is more important than accomplishing things. I agree. Their parents are outraged by this kind of talk, so I don't go into it. I just say, the kids came. The parents say, that's good. At least they have a sense of duty. I think they have a sense of love.
Well, I wasn't necessarily going to read this, but it does kind of tie in about parents and children, and adults and children, I should say, not necessarily parents. Milne called the good little girl, and I didn't rehearse it well because I wasn't necessarily intending to do it. It's funny how often they say to me, Jane, have you been a good girl? Have you been a good girl? And when they have said it, they say it again. Have you been a good girl? Have you been a good girl? I go to a party. I go out to tea. I go to an aunt for a week at the sea. I come back from school and from playing a game. Wherever I come from, it's always the same. Well, have you been a good girl, Jane? It's always the end of the loveliest day. Have you been a good girl? Have you been a good girl? I went to the zoo and they waited to say, have you been a good girl? Have you been a good girl? Well, what did they think I went there to do? And why should I want to be bad at the zoo? And if I should be, am I likely to say that I had? So that's why it's funny of Mummy and Dad, this asking and asking in case I was bad. Well, have you been a good girl, Jane?
I've got one more from Tamara. This is the title of the book, If You Have a Thousand Reasons for Living. If you never feel alone, if you wake up wanting to sing, if everything speaks to you, from the stone in the road to the star in the sky, from the loitering lizard to the fish, lord of the sea, if you understand the winds and listen to the silence, rejoice, for love walks with you. Love is your comrade. Love is your friend.
one more that I want to share. It's called Comes the Dawn. After a while, you learn the subtle difference between holding a hand and chaining a soul. And you learn that love doesn't mean leaning and company doesn't mean security. And you begin to learn that kisses aren't contracts and presents aren't promises. And you begin to accept your defeats with your head up and your eyes open, with the grace of maturity and not the eyes of a child. And you learn to build all your roads on today, because tomorrow's ground is too uncertain for plans, and futures have a way of falling in mid-flight. After a while, you learn that even sunshine burns if you get too much.
So if you button a button in a buttonhole, not the right one, it then becomes impossible to button up the other ones.
Right.
And it closes off. Are you going to close this off?
I don't work with many American poets. So I was recently introduced to Emily Dickinson. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us. Don't tell. They'll advertise, you know.
Banish us from hell.
How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell one's name the livelong June to an admiring bog.
There's a lot of lines to that too. They banish us from hell.
I think I finally admitted to the fact that I am dysfunctional. I'm from a dysfunctional family. And I think it's finally time that I do something about it. And I wrote this poem when I was feeling very, from what I know, dysfunctionality, very typical dysfunctional feelings as far as wanting to please everyone and wanting to always say yes. And it was finally catching up to me and I just couldn't say yes anymore. And it's entitled Work Ethic. I say I will do, I am bound by my expectations and the expectations of others. If I say I will try, I am released from my expectations but still a servant of others. If I say I will allow, the Spirit is free to move in and work through me, and what is done is acceptable by all.